I would say the Latin Mass is a big part of my faith life, and I'm just sad to see it go.
Reaction from parishioners after restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass go into effect in the Diocese of Charlotte. We take a step back to explore the beauty of the liturgy and ask why different forms of the Latin Rite Mass have sparked what some call the liturgy wars.
Someone who says that I'm against abortion, but I'm in agreement with the inhuman treatment of immigrants who are in the United States, I don't know if that's pro-life.
Pope Leo responds to a festering political and religious controversy about a pro-abortion senator who was to receive a Catholic Lifetime Achievement Award for his support of immigrants. The debate causing cracks within the ranks of the U.S. Catholic bishops.
This place has so much history, and this is where we come and we pray to St. Joseph.
And we travel to Montreal to visit the world's largest shrine dedicated to the foster father of Jesus. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
This community has done nothing to go against the unity of the church. And at this parish, both communities have thrived, the Novus Ordo community and the Latin Mass community.
The liturgy debate reignited this week as restrictions limiting the traditional Latin Mass in Charlotte, North Carolina, were put into place Thursday. As a thriving faith community adapts to these changes, many in the church discuss whether unity requires uniformity. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. The Diocese of Charlotte is just the latest in the U.S. to implement sweeping restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass. The topic is a sensitive one, often with heightened emotions, particularly for the small but thriving communities who love the old Mass. The traditional Latin Mass, also called the extraordinary form, was the most common form of the Mass for centuries in the church. In this rite, the liturgy is entirely in Latin, and the priest celebrates facing the same direction as the people. In the traditional Latin Mass, the readings come from the Gospels, preceded typically by an epistle from St. Paul. In 1970, the church implemented the Novus Ordo, or new form of the Mass. This rite includes readings from the Old Testament, and while Latin is still the official language of the church, the Novus Ordo permits the Mass in modern local languages. It also allows the priest to face the congregation. A Pew survey this summer found that 2% of American Catholics attend the traditional Latin Mass at least weekly. 1% attend once or twice a month, and 2% go a few times a year. Yet, many churches which offer the Latin Mass say it continues to draw crowds. Some U.S. dioceses have faced controversy over what's seen as severe restrictions tamping down on a flourishing part of their flock. That now includes Charlotte, where faithful are now limited to a single chapel for the extraordinary form, a space even Bishop Michael Martin has acknowledged will not accommodate the entire community.
From the first time I heard about this, I would say that it broke my heart.
Catholics outside St. Anne Parish in Charlotte reflect on their love for the traditional Latin Mass. They filled the church on Wednesday for its final Mass in the extraordinary form, a part of the parish's liturgical life for more than a decade. EWTN News was not allowed inside for filming, but spoke to some of the faithful who attended.
Just a grave disappointment because I feel like it's unnecessary.
Our whole family's pretty heartbroken.
Brian Williams, co-founder of the Charlotte Latin Mass, the community has steadily grown since Sunday Latin Masses became available in 2013.
And what you began to see were people who just had no familiarity with this Mass, but just kind of found it and started going to it. We have on average between 1,200 to 1,500 people every Sunday going to these four Latin Masses.
Former Bishop Peter Jugis, who headed the Diocese of Charlotte for more than 20 years, was very supportive of the Latin Mass community. But an apostolic letter compelled him and all bishops to begin to limit the extraordinary form. In 2021, the late Pope Francis issued his motu proprio, Traditionis Custodes, Latin for guardians of the tradition. The apostolic letter calls for bishops to regulate the celebration of the Latin Mass in their dioceses, limiting it to non-parish churches. It was a stark change from his predecessors, Pope St. John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI, who gave priests broad rights to celebrate the extraordinary form. Retired theology professor Dr. Larry Chapp says Francis saw the presence of the traditional Latin Mass as a source of division in his flock.
The Latin Mass had proliferated and had grown very popular in certain circles, and Pope Francis apparently viewed that as a threat to the standard, the ordinary form of the liturgy.
Dr. Joseph Shaw, president of Una Voce International, sees how bishops around the world have implemented Traditiones Custodes.
The lesson I draw from that is that there's very little enthusiasm among bishops to crush the traditional Mass. What's happened in America has been quite extreme.
Many dioceses and archdioceses, including Chicago, Detroit, Washington, D.C., and Seattle, have implemented Traditiones Custodes.
Most dioceses had followed this. The Diocese of Charlotte had not.
In 2023, after Pope Francis issued a rescript clarifying Traditiones Custodes, Bishop Jugis announced he would limit the Latin Mass in Charlotte from 9 parishes to 4 and received a 2-year dispensation from Rome to delay further restrictions until October 2nd of this year. After his resignation in 2024, Bishop Michael Martin was installed as the new head of the diocese. This May, just a year into his tenure, he announced he would continue implementing those restrictions. Dr. Timothy O'Malley, academic director at the Notre Dame Center for Liturgy, says he was continuing the work of his predecessor.
When Bishop Martin came in, you know, he began to actually implement what many dioceses had already done, which was to sort of follow that it could be at a shrine or a chapel, but it could not be at a parish church.
Martin announced that starting July 8th, the traditional Latin Mass would only be celebrated on Sundays at a new chapel to further promote the concord and unity of the church in his diocese. His announcement faced significant backlash at home and beyond. Charlotte's Latin Mass community was surprised the implementation would happen before the Vatican's deadline.
They were hoping to hear maybe a further dispensation or some additional time being granted maybe. And instead, they were told they were actually losing 3 months.
The controversy expanded when a leaked document showed sweeping liturgical norms for all masses, including banning the use of Latin and altar rails. As this backlash mounted, the diocesan newspaper Catholic News Herald reported the deadline would move back to October 2nd, stating the extra time would help with the transition and renovating the new chapel.
For years, the Charlotte Latin Mass community had asked for a dedicated chapel. But that dedicated chapel was something that would be the sacraments, the traditional sacraments, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a dedicated priest or priests. This has been explicitly stated is just a building to use for 2 masses on Sunday, and that is it. They have said intentionally that it's not to build community.
Mooresville's Chapel of the Little Flower, which cost some $700,000 to renovate, can only fit a little more than 350 people, meaning there are not enough pews for the more than 1,000 people who typically attend the TLM. The diocese chose Mooresville as the site of the new chapel because it sits between 2 of its largest TLM communities. But its location means many must drive more than 2 hours to attend.
Mooresville, for me, is long, long way.
Faithful who regularly attend the traditional Latin Mass have to decide whether they will stay at their parish or travel to Mooresville for the extraordinary form.
Yes.
Yeah, we love St. Anne's, but we need to go where the Latin Mass is.
We won't be able to do it every Sunday. We will do it at times. And we also love this parish.
Bishop Martin and the Diocese of Charlotte did not make themselves available for an interview, but said earlier this year in the Catholic News Herald they would abide by any new guidance the Vatican releases on the traditional Latin Mass. Charlotte Catholics hope to see their beloved liturgy return one day.
We will offer those losses and that pain for the world and for the church.
This is the last Latin Mass now. It's going to return as it happened before.
from the Tar Heel State to the Sacred City. The election of Pope Leo XIV this year has prompted many Catholics to wonder what action, if any, our new Holy Father will take when it comes to Tradiciones Custodes, including whether he will loosen restrictions. While Leo has said very little on the matter so far, he did comment about the extraordinary form of the Mass with the Catholic outlet Crux, saying in part, "There is another issue, which is also another hot-button issue, which I have already received a number of requests and letters about. The question about, people always say, the Latin Mass. Well, you can say Mass in Latin right now. If it's the Vatican II Rite, there's no problem. Obviously, between the Tridentine Mass and the Vatican II Mass, the Mass of Paul VI, I'm not sure where that's going to go. It's obviously very complicated. I do know that part of the issue, unfortunately, has become, again, part of a process of polarization. People have used the liturgy as an excuse for advancing other topics. It's become a political tool, and that is very unfortunate." And what may be another signal of what's to come, Cardinal Raymond Burr will celebrate a special traditional Latin Mass in St. Peter's Basilica this month, a return to a prior custom that's been suspended since 2022 as part of an annual pilgrimage of Catholics devoted to the Latin Mass. Burr will celebrate the solemn pontifical Mass on the second day of the Summorum Pontificum pilgrimage. EWTN News senior Vatican analyst Frank Rocha says Pope Leo's comments on the TLM and now this news of Cardinal Burr all point to a possibly more conciliatory approach by our Holy Father on the extraordinary form of the Mass.
Pope Leo met with Cardinal Burr recently, and now he's allowing this to happen, as I say, at least indirectly. He certainly wouldn't be happening if the Pope weren't in favor of it. So maybe that's a sign, again, of an olive branch of peace offering, of attempt to reconcile this with this group that Pope Francis really kind of singled out for tough treatment.
Those devoted to the TLM have said the upcoming celebration of the solemn pontifical Mass in St. Peter's is an important sign of increased tolerance for the traditional liturgy. Joining us now on the record to discuss the beauty of the liturgy in the Catholic Church from the traditional Latin Mass to the Novus Ordo and for his response to the so-called liturgy wars is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln in Nebraska. Your Excellency, thank you for joining us for this conversation. First, when Pope Francis released the apostolic letter Traditiones Custodes in 2021, how did you personally discern how to implement it in your specific Diocese of Lincoln?
Well, I think I'm in kind of a unique diocese because we are the national headquarters for the Fraternity of St. Peter's Seminary in the North American District. So we have about 90 seminarians who are with the FSSP, and they are being trained and formed and ordained to go out and to serve in those parishes in North America that exclusively use the 1962 Missal and the liturgical books from the pre-Vatican Council Mass. And so I kind of inherited that from my predecessor, Bishop Breskowitz, and we've had always a very good relationship with the fraternity. We have a fraternity parish in my diocese, which is staffed by fraternity priests. And then we have the Carmelite Monastery here, which exclusively uses the old Mass. And so I have frequent opportunity to celebrate the old Mass in all those different settings and contexts. Plus, we have several parishes that have a Sunday Mass according to the 62 Missal. Mm-hmm. So when Traditiones Custodes came out in the first month or so, I granted, while I could, a dispensation from place so that they could fall under the, before the dubium came out, that they would fall within the context of what Traditiones Custodes was calling for. So that's how sort of we dealt with the Traditiones Custodes. Mm.
And how did your personal formation when it comes to the liturgy inform that discernment for your diocese?
Well, I'm a convert, an adult convert to the Catholic faith. So I was received into the church when I was in college, my junior year in college. So I kind of came into the Catholic Church through kind of an intellectual kind of, I read my way into the church, as I like to say sometimes. And so I studied, you know, the history of the Mass. And then when I became, when I discerned a vocation to the priesthood, and was being formed in seminary, I always had a great interest in the history of the Mass and the liturgy. And I've always been very close to the Benedictine monastery in France, Fontcombeau. And so I guess a lot of my friends entered that monastery. Mm. So I've had a lot of exposure to the traditional Mass. Mm-hmm. But when I was ordained a priest, of course, ordained in the Novus Ordo, and mm-hmm. As I'm a bishop and a priest, I was auxiliary bishop in Denver, and then I've been here now for almost 13 years. I primarily celebrate the Novus Ordo Mass, of mm-hmm. course, but I enjoy having the opportunity to celebrate the old Mass from time to time, quite frequently, actually.
Mm. Well, as you well know, Catholics have strong feelings about the TLM. It's difficult to speak on this topic without it becoming highly charged. Why is that?
I think it's still the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, where it was such a change in the way we approach the liturgy that there still is this dynamic of pre and post. Mm-hmm. And I think Benedict did a lot to kind of try and, try to sow the complementarity of the two forms of the Mass. So what he liked to talk about is the cross-pollination, that the Novus Ordo came out of the traditional Mass, and that we have to know our roots. And I think some think that the Mass in before the Council was so different than the Mass after the Council, that anything that harkens back to the past is somehow wrong or invalid or whatever, however they want to put it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you get into the friction and tension, the sort of pre and post. Whereas I like to think of it as all part of the same tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be part of it. It goes back to Jesus Christ. And the Mass is formed and developed over the centuries.
Mm-hmm. You hit on my next question, Your Excellency, because liturgy reflects doctrine, but some Catholics equate changes to liturgy to changes to doctrine. Is that the case with Vatican II and the new rite?
Well, no, you're probably referring to lex orandi, lex credendi. You know, we believe what we pray, and as we emerged, from apostolic times, the development of the liturgy kind of coexisted with the development of doctrine as well. And there has not been doctrinal change in the church. It's developed, as John Henry Cardinal Newman, now Doctor of the Church, mm-hmm. Teaches so beautifully. And the liturgy has formed alongside with the development of doctrine over the centuries. Mm-hmm. And I believe, too, that, what we're experiencing now with the friction, I think eventually will mature that as well. And this back and forth, there's a great, as you probably know, there's a great attraction to all things traditional by young people, this new generation. And they come at it in a kind of a refreshing way, I think. They're not so much caught up in the liturgical wars. They just recognize beauty and reverence, and they want that. Because we live in such a secularized world, they have a longing for the transcendence. And when they experience, for example, a Latin Mass or even an Eastern Rite Mass, and they see all the beauty of it, whether it be the bells and smells or the liturgical vestments or the reverence, they're attracted to that because mm-hmm. their world, I think, of this new generation, Gen Z as it's called, is so, it's so transient and it's changing all the time. They're looking for something that doesn't change and that's rooted in something that's larger than themselves.
Bishop Conley, some Catholics who love the Latin Mass have begun attending Mass at SSPX chapels. The Society of St. Pius X is a traditionalist group not in full communion with the Catholic Church, and it has a canonically irregular status. That being said, what is your message to Catholics who feel a draw to SSPX when the traditional Latin Mass is not readily available to them?
Well, that's, I think, where the Fraternity of St. Peter comes in, and that was precisely why John Paul II established the Fraternity of St. Peter to started, of course, with priests who were in SSPX, and they came and showed their fidelity to when the split took place in 88, when when the Archbishop Lefebvre consecrated those four bishops, then a group of fraternity priests came to John Paul II, and they wanted to remain in union and communion with the church in Rome. And they realized that this was a real split, a schism. And so that's why the Fraternity of St. Peter was founded. And Fraternity of St. Peter has spread throughout the world as precisely something that would be available to people in union with the Church in Rome and the present Pope, as an alternative to having to go to, let's say, a Society of St. Pius X Church.
Mm-hmm. And my final minute with you, Your Excellency, I did want to mention this, that you sit on the board of the Benedict XVI Institute. Tell us the latest about what you are doing to help cultivate greater reverence for the sacred liturgy right now.
Right. We just had a board meeting yesterday, so it was very timely. And we've just launched this new, what's called the Reverent Liturgy Project, through the Benedict XVI Institute, founded by Archbishop Salvatore Corleone, the Archbishop of San Francisco, which is a very kind of practical initiative to help priests and lay faithful and musicians, especially in the area of sacred music, to further enhance and renew a reverence for everything liturgical, beginning from the altar out. And you can go to our website and see this project and learn about it, to develop and cultivate a greater reverence, greater more beautiful music, and just an overall appreciation of the beauty of the liturgy, both in the old form and the new form.
Bishop James Conley, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your voice with our viewers. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Restriction on the traditional Latin Mass was not the only issue this week where sentiments and opinions were running high. Next, the hotly criticized decision to recognize the achievements of a pro-abortion senator even brought comments from Pope Leo into the fray.
We need to, you know, really look closely at all of these ethical issues and to find the way forward as church.
Pope Leo wades into a controversy involving a Catholic award that was to be given to a U.S. senator from Illinois. We go in depth with reaction and context to a situation that pitted bishop against bishop. And later.
I'm Mark Irons here at a world-famous shrine to St. Joseph. In Montreal, millions of visitors come to Canada every year to this place of prayer and healing. That story coming up.
Welcome back. Following mounting Catholic backlash, Chicago's Cardinal Blaise Cupich announced this week that Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin will decline an award from the Archdiocese of Chicago. Durbin was scheduled to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award for support to immigrants in early November from the Archdiocese's Human Dignity and Solidarity Office. But there was growing criticism of the honor because of Durbin's pro-abortion record, including criticism from at least 10 U.S. bishops. In a lengthy statement released Tuesday, Cardinal Cupich says Senator Durbin informed him he had decided not to receive the award. Cupich said the award was specifically for his singular contribution to immigration reform and unwavering support of immigrants. And he went on to say, in part, quote, "As I look back on my 50 years as a priest and 27 years as a bishop, I have seen the divisions within the Catholic community dangerously deepen. These divisions harm the unity of the church and undermine our witness to the gospel. Total condemnation is not the way forward, for it shuts down discussion. But praise and encouragement can open it up by asking their recipients to consider how to extend their good work to other areas and issues." Cardinal Cupich's announcement shortly followed Pope Leo XIV's comments on the matter, which sparked global headlines. The Holy Father spoke with reporters outside of his papal villa of Castel Gandolfo Tuesday evening, including with our EWTN News Vatican correspondent, who asked Pope Leo about the Chicago controversy and his guidance to Catholics on how to think about it.
I'm not terribly familiar with the particular case. I think that it's very important to look at the overall work that a senator has done during, if I'm not mistaken, 40 years of service in the United States Senate. I understand the difficulty and the tensions, But I think, as I myself have spoken in the past, it's important to look at many issues that are related to what is the teaching of the church. Someone who says I'm against abortion but says I'm in favor of the death penalty is not really pro-life. So someone who says that I'm against abortion but I'm in agreement with the inhuman treatment of immigrants who are in the United States, I don't know if that's pro-life. So they're very complex issues. I don't know if anyone has all the truth on them, but I would ask first and foremost that there be greater respect for one another and that we search together, both as human beings, in that case as American citizens or citizens of the state of Illinois, as well as Catholics, to say we need to, you know, really look closely at all of these ethical issues and to find the way forward as church. The church teaching on each one of those issues is very clear.
Pope Leo himself is a Chicago native and former Illinois resident. Our senior Vatican analyst says the Pope's comments hit on an ongoing dispute among U.S. bishops on whether abortion should be the preeminent priority of their public policy agenda.
He went out of his way to criticize people who are, for example, against abortion but in favor of the death penalty, or against abortion and not for helping migrants. He didn't say that he was so much worried about people who are for helping migrants or against the death penalty, but who are permissive on abortion. I think it's a strong statement that he thinks, yes, abortion, bad, terrible, but we really need to also give a heavy, heavy emphasis to the rights of migrants. The death penalty, for example, he brought that up.
Upon hearing the Pope's comments, Senator Durbin told NBC News he was, quote, overwhelmed by what he saw as support from the Holy Father, but he said it did not make him rethink his decision to decline the award. To help us break down the latest in this ongoing and now global news story, we are joined by two leading Catholic voices right here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Mary Fiorito is an attorney and one of the nation's leading Catholic voices on the life issue, currently the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mary was selected by the late Cardinal Joseph Bernardine to lead the Archdiocese of Chicago's Respect Life office, where she went on to hold several leading roles in the church, including having served as the executive assistant to the late Cardinal Francis George. And Dr. Matthew Bunsen is the vice president and editorial director of EWTN News, a Catholic theologian and historian. Matthew is a veteran Catholic journalist and the author of the first English language biography of Pope Leo XIV, Pope Leo, Portrait of the First American Pope. Thank you both for being here. This news story is causing quite the reaction. So first things first, what did you both make of what Pope Leo XIV had to say? How did you interpret it? Matthew, is he equating the evil of abortion with the death penalty and care for the migrant?
Yeah, well, I think he's not demoting abortion, contrary to what we're seeing in a lot of the spin, certainly in secular media. This is not, in fact, the first time that he has addressed these issues and in this way. This is actually the third time he has done so in the last several years. Before he was elected Pope as Cardinal Prevost, he gave a speech in Chiclayo in Peru in 2023 addressing the idea of basically what he just talked about, mm-hmm. looking at the totality of how we consider ourselves to be pro-life. Mm-hmm. He finished that speech, however, very significantly by reminding everyone that there are different levels of church teaching, that there is a hierarchy mm-hmm. of moral questions that we face. Right after his election as Pope, barely 8 days after, he spoke with the ambassador to the Holy See. He used exactly the same language in terms that no one is exempt from defending life, but defending it in all of the dignity of the human person in all of the different ways that we can. So again, he goes back to clarifying right at the very end, he even did in this speech, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. his answer to mm-hmm. our questions, mm-hmm. talking about church teaching is very clear here.
Yeah, exactly. He ended it on that note. Mary, your thoughts?
I think he was trying to give a message that really speaks to the depth of the church's teaching on life issues and not to sort of pigeonhole it into just abortion only. And certainly we see that in Evangelium Vitae, St. John Paul II's beautiful document that gives us guidance, where you had a number of different life issues that were linked. Unfortunately, I think we've seen, particularly in the American media, a real concerted effort to take cherry-pick some of his comments, take them, and then give them the impression that he was implying that abortion is just not all that important anymore and don't hold anybody's feet to the fire just on abortion.
And we saw this for 12 years with Pope Francis.
Right. And here we are now at the beginning of a new pontificate. And it does hit on an American debate, which we'll get to momentarily. But Mary, as I mentioned in your introduction, you used to lead the Respect Life Office in the Archdiocese of Chicago. And it was the Archdiocese's now Office of Human Dignity and Solidarity that intended to award Senator Durbin despite his pro-abortion record. In his statement, I want to pull this up for our viewers, Cardinal Supich said, "The tragic reality in our nation today is that there are essentially no Catholic public officials who consistently pursue the essential elements of Catholic social teaching because our party system will not permit them to do so." Mary, can you shed some insight from when you worked for the church in Chicago? How did you discern these matters and whether or not to publicly engage with Catholic politicians?
Well, we had a longstanding policy on what would be honors and awards and also public speaking. So, so for example, if a politician wanted to come to a parish and speak on a particular issue and he or she had a very bad track record on abortion, generally we would say if there's going to be an open forum where questions can be asked and there is real dialogue, or it's a debate-like format where you would have someone representing the church's point of view and then the politician can express their point of view. And that would also then, of course, give constituents the ability to say, hey, I like what you're doing here, but boy, your position on abortion is really a problem. So at the time, of course, too, Roe versus Wade was still in effect. So there was very little until Planned Parenthood versus Casey came out that you could do at the state and local level anyway with abortion. So, you know, we had a parental notice law in Illinois that was very strong. And unfortunately, Governor Pritzker repealed that. And so now, you know, you have unlimited abortions for minors without their parents knowing. But, you know, back then, the constraints were much different.
And it was a different discernment you had to do.
Correct.
It was a different moment in the pro-life.
Very different political. Right, exactly.
Matthew, when the late Pope Francis would weigh in on U.S. political issues, many people would brush his comments aside and say, well, he doesn't understand American political dynamics. But Pope Leo is the first U.S.-born pope. He does have a certain understanding and insight there. And these comments hit on something that is very hotly debated right now, and we've already alluded to that. Can you provide even more background and context on how the Pope's comments hit on the debate bishops are having?
Yeah, that's right. And Pope Leo is very clear that he is aware of the fact that he is the first U.S.-born pope. He talked about it in his sit-down interview that was recently published. One of the things that I think has happened here, and we have seen it from the very beginning of Pope Leo's pontificate, and that is his stress on unity. To borrow the colloquialism, he is trying to bring down the temperature a bit. So here we have him suddenly facing what was starting off as a local controversy in giving an award to a pro-abortion politician that understandably exploded onto the national scene, given where we are politically, but also given where we are in some cases among the bishops themselves who are divided on how to approach some of these issues. Pope Leo, in his answer, talks about, in his answer to us, talks about the fact that he wants to have all of us coming together, working together, as we try to discern how we deal with these ethical issues. The stress on unity, I think, is at the heart of what he's trying to accomplish, and he has talked unity from the day of his election. And so I think his message to the U.S. bishops is, let's calm the waters a little bit and work together to solve some of these problems. Now, the question is how the U.S. bishops, in some cases, are going to respond.
Yeah, which we might see more of that next month at their General Assembly. Mary, I want to give the last word to you in our remaining minute. How have these comments resonated with the pro-life community? You're involved with the pro-life movement on the local and national stage.
Well, I think there was, you know, frustration because many years ago, when this first started to be a problem with pro-abortion politicians wanting to speak in Catholic venues or, you know, a school, for example, wanting to honor an alum that was an elected official who supported abortion, that's when the Bishops' Conference nationally and also at the Archdiocese of Chicago locally developed clear, distinct policies that gave guidance and guidelines, right? So if someone has been casting votes consistently, has been very vocal on the abortion issue, and opposes the church's fundamental moral teaching, we really shouldn't be giving that person platforms, honors, or awards. So I think everyone was just very frustrated because we've been through all of this before, you know, and there are the policies. And And for the most part, schools and parishes and other institutions have abided by them. So all of a sudden, this sort of came out of the blue. I think it surprised a lot of people. Mm. A lot of people were very hurt because Senator Durbin has been so, so extreme on the abortion issue. I mean, there's sort of general pro-life politicians, and then there's pro-choice politicians, and then there's Senator Durbin. I mean, he voted against life-saving care for babies who survive abortions. He supported partial birth abortions, late-term abortions, really out there, even for a pro-choice politician of long standing.
And Bishop Papraki is the bishop of his home.
That's correct. So Senator Durbin is from Springfield, Illinois. Mm-hmm. He votes in Springfield, Illinois. He pays his property taxes in Springfield, Illinois. He now says that he identifies as a member of the Archdiocese of Chicago. He keeps an apartment in Chicago, as many politicians do, because our governor, Governor Pritzker, doesn't live in the governor's mansion in Springfield. He keeps his home in Chicago. So he comes to Chicago for, you know, meetings and other things, and apparently to attend Mass, where he is permitted to receive Holy Communion. But for decades in Springfield, Bishop Papraki, who is his bishop, and the bishops who preceded him, Archbishop Lucas and Bishop Van, have barred him from Holy Communion. So there was an issue about where he was actually domiciled. And canon law is very specific that the bishop of the place in which you're domiciled has jurisdiction over you.
We'll have to leave it right there, unfortunately. Mary and Matthew, so grateful for both of your insights. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. A shocked Britain reacts to what authorities are calling a terrorist incident after a brazen and fatal attack at a synagogue on Yom Kippur. That story tops the Week in Review. Two people were killed and at least three others seriously wounded Thursday after a man rammed his car into people outside the synagogue and then jumped out and started stabbing them.
On Yom Kippur, the holiest day for the Jewish community, a vile individual committed a terrorist attack that attack Jews because they are Jews.
Prime Minister Keir Starmer condemns what he called the horrific incident at the Manchester Synagogue in northern England and pledged increased policing at synagogues around the country. Police shot and killed the suspect, who drove his car directly at the victims as they gathered outside their Orthodox synagogue, and he was never able to get inside. Investigators identify him as a British citizen of Syrian descent. Anti-Semitic incidences in the UK have soared since the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel and Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Manchester has the second largest Jewish community in Britain after London. Investigators say the gunman who drove his pickup truck through the front doors of a Mormon church in Michigan last Sunday before shooting congregants inside and setting it on fire had a long simmering hate for the Church of Latter-day Saints. Four people died and eight others were wounded before police shot and killed Thomas Sanford. His friends say Sanford had been in a relationship with a Mormon woman some time ago and had felt pressure to join the church. A local city council candidate says he encountered the former Marine just 6 days before the shooting while door knocking for his campaign.
The first question that he had was like, what's your position on guns? I said, I support the Second Amendment. That was really the end of it. And then the very next question, and he leans in, he goes, what do you know about Mormons?
Chris Johns says Sanford spent the next 15 minutes talking about Mormons, calling them the Antichrist who would take over the world. But Johns sensed no threat or indication of impending violence. The fire the suspect set burnt the church to the ground. In the meantime, Latter-day Saints churchgoers launched a fundraising campaign for his family, saying his wife and two sons are also victims of this tragedy. It's the first full weekend of the U.S. government shutdown, which began at midnight on Wednesday. With an impasse in Congress over how to fund the government, there appears to be no end in sight. The shutdown forces approximately 750,000 federal employees into unpaid furloughs and grinds key public services to a halt, including the release of key economic data that was to be announced on Friday from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Without the September jobs report, businesses and policymakers are flying blind regarding which way the economy is going. On Friday, Congress voted on dueling stopgap bills from Republicans and Democrats. both failed. Each side is accusing the other of holding the government hostage. The Trump administration is now threatening mass layoffs and firing of federal workers to make up for government shortfalls. With a near-complete closure of many federal agencies, some personnel deemed essential, like air traffic controllers, continue to work but without pay. Meanwhile, a government shutdown impacting everyday Americans will not stop the flow this month of a $20 billion financial lifeline to Argentina. The Trump administration has pledged a bailout for Argentina's faltering economy and to assist President Javier Milei, a Trump favorite, as his party faces a difficult midterm election later this month. The move to use U.S. tax dollars this way has infuriated many American farmers who have been hard hit by tariffs, which have dried up all orders from China, one of the agriculture sector's biggest customers. The American Soybean Association says the administration's economic rescue plan for Argentina particularly stings because Argentina is now undercutting U.S. farmers and selling tons of soybeans to China. A high-level meeting at the White House on Monday between President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which they unveiled a 20-point ceasefire plan to halt the war in Gaza. The U.S. proposal would put Gaza's territory under international control, deploy an international security force, and install a so-called Board of Peace to oversee the administration and reconstruction of Gaza. It stipulates that Hamas disarm, have no future role in governing Gaza, and turn over all remaining hostages within 3 days of the ceasefire. Largely favorable to Israel, the plan allows Israeli forces to maintain a security perimeter inside Gaza. Hamas must decide whether or not to accept the plan in the next few days. It is expected they will demand some key revisions. An unprecedented meeting of all of America's top generals and admirals this week at Marine Corps Base Quantico in Virginia. More than 800 of them called from their service posts around the globe to attend an in-person speech by Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. His address emphasized physical fitness standards and appearance. No more fat troops, he said. And he told the gathered leaders that many were promoted for wrong reasons based on race and gender quotas. He called for an end to what he called woke culture in the military.
We also don't fight with stupid rules of engagement. We untie the hands of our warfighters to intimidate, demoralize, hunt, and kill the enemies of our country. No more politically correct and overbearing rules of engagement.
Hegseth said he would impose male standards for combat troops, and he told those who don't share his vision for the military that they could resign. After his speech, President Trump took the stage and told the military leaders to get ready for possible deployment of active duty troops into American cities.
San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, they're very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one. And this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too. It's a war from within. I told Pete we should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military.
While some administration supporters praised the president and defense secretary's messages to the top brass, many others called the speeches political theater and criticized the tone of the speeches, the president's willingness to use military force against Americans, and the secretary's call to loosen the rules of engagement, which have been used in previous wars to protect the lives of civilians and protect against torture of enemy combatants. The auditorium of generals and admirals was notably silent during the speeches. They did not clap or cheer, but maintained neutral military decorum. Pope Leo himself addressed the Trump administration's internal renaming of the Department of Defense as the Department of War. It's a name change which will not become official unless Congress votes to make it so. Asked about it by reporters, the Pope called the choice of vocabulary worrying because he said it shows an increase in tensions. He said he hopes it is only a way of speaking. The pontiff commented that instead of war, one must always work for peace. Pope Leo presided Wednesday over a 10th anniversary celebration of Pope Francis's landmark encyclical Laudato Si as he embraced his predecessor's environmental legacy. The encyclical says care for God's creation and people harmed by its exploitation is an urgent and existential moral concern. Among the hundreds of guests from environmental and indigenous groups gathered at Castel Gandolfo was former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who also spoke.
The Catholic Church has 1.4 billion members. 1.4 billion Catholics out there. 400,000 priests. 600,000 nuns. 200,000 churches. Now think about that. That power. And for that to be involved in our movement, in our environmental movement, to terminate pollution.
Leo told those gathered that individual efforts to end global warming are not enough, and that advocates need to pressure national governments to develop tougher stands to mitigate damage from global warming that's already occurred. It's October, and that means the U.S. Supreme Court is back in session for its fall term, with several major cases set for oral argument. At EWTN News, we are following with special interest Childs versus Salazar, which will be argued next week. It centers on whether a licensed counselor has the First Amendment right to discuss religious beliefs while counseling a young person struggling with gender dysphoria. State of West Virginia versus BPJ and Little versus Hecox are two cases involving athletes who identify as transgender seeking to compete on their school's athletic teams, and First Choice Women's Resource Centers versus Plotkin about the state of New Jersey's attempt to investigate a group of faith-based pregnancy centers, including their donors list and other sensitive documents. EWTN News will provide coverage and analysis of these and other major Supreme Court cases from the fall 2025 term in the weeks and months to come. We'll be right back.
They were all agreeing on one thing. If those mysterious healings happen here, it is because St. Joseph dwells here.
Why do millions of visitors come to this Catholic shrine every year? We go to Montreal, Canada to find out in a moment.
High on a hill in Montreal sits a magnificent structure, a Catholic basilica and Canada's largest church, St. Joseph's Oratory. It took 6 decades to build this shrine dedicated to the patron saint of workers and families, but it likely would not have happened without a humble man whose devotion to St. Joseph helped champion the project. As Mark Irons reports from Montreal, that simple servant would become a revered saint himself.
The minute you see this place, even if you don't know the background and the history, you sort of fall in love with this place. And it pulls you towards something higher.
Drawn to something higher here on Mount Royal in Montreal, millions of visitors from around the world continue to come year after year, decade after decade. Like so many others, we walked toward the enormous dome, past the stone marker in the front reading, Ite ad Joseph, a Latin phrase which means go to Joseph.
We're in the heart of the basilica here, so we're in this huge space.
It's massive.
It is massive. And
David Bureau is the archivist of St. Joseph's Oratory.
We are a big place.
This basilica is Canada's largest church and the largest shrine in the world dedicated to St. Joseph, the foster father of Jesus.
At the heart of it is really the prayer to St. Joseph, the devotion to St. Joseph.
We pray for him to intercede for us.
Monir and his wife Danielle, Montreal locals, come here often.
St. Joseph is a very special man and a good example. He was a very quiet man, but he listened to God.
They pray to Joseph and another local born in 1845 who gained a reputation as the miracle worker of Montreal, who founded this world-renowned holy site.
For us, it's important. He's a local, you know, so he's our saint.
Saint André Bassett grew up in poverty. Both his parents died when he was young. He lacked a solid education and suffered from frail health, but he developed a strong faith and was accepted as a religious brother into the Congregation of the Holy Cross with this recommendation from a priest.
He's not fit to be a teacher. He does not have a good health, but he knows how to pray. And they took him in.
Among his responsibilities within the religious community, Brother André was the doorman at Notre Dame College in Montreal, where for years he welcomed people inside. They started to find out the problems they came in with would eventually leave.
People started telling him, well, my wife is sick, she has a bad cold. My brother broke his ankle, he can't work no more. And Brother André would start saying, well, I'm going to pray for them, and I'm going to pray to Saint Joseph.
The prayers of Brother André were followed by reports of the miraculous. Brother André was a man of simple and humble faith. Many people would visit him looking to be healed, but he wouldn't take the credit. Instead, he would point them to a much higher spiritual authority, placing them in the care of Saint Joseph.
From one to another, people started saying, hey, you know what? If you feel sick or if your family is sick, go see Brother André at the college and ask him to pray Saint Joseph for you. And that's how this reputation started to spread.
The college, still standing today, was overwhelmed with visitors coming to see this humble Canadian. But across from the college was open land on Mount Royal. The Holy Cross congregation bought the land and built a small chapel in honor of Saint Joseph. Brother André was named the guardian, and people continued to flock there.
It became serious when the papers got a hold on it.
Brother André's reputation continued to grow, and so did the devotion to Saint Joseph. And that small chapel, completed on the open ground across from the college in 1904, was just the beginning. The vision evolved with different architectural influences, and completion was decades in the making. Halted by economic crisis in the early 1930s, as the world-famous dome was under construction in 1937, Brother André passed away. But the iconic oratory officially opened about 20 years later and continues to stand tall, overlooking the city.
J'ai adoré aussi le feeling.
On the Basilica's observation terrace, we met Aziza, a Muslim woman from Montreal. She said she likes visiting, and the inside of the church is peaceful.
People are surprised by the size, but also by the quiet that comes from this sanctuary.
2 million people come each year. It's a place where you can pray, light a candle, and see crutches left behind, evidence of the healings experienced here. And you can visit the tomb of Saint André Basset. Details in the arches, hallways, stained glass, and mosaics throughout the basilica point visitors to the saint Brother André loved.
It was made as a way to lead people to St. Joseph's. Every stained glass windows that we have on both sides of the basilica tells a story of a miracle of St. Joseph that happened in Canada, in the history of Canada.
Joseph is the patron saint of Canada, and in 1870 was declared patron of the Universal Church. David believes it's St. Joseph's closeness to Christ and relatability that draws people in.
When you put your faith in St. Joseph, you put it in someone who might be just like you. He's a working man. He's a family man. He took care of a child. He took care of his bride. He received inspiration by God. He didn't know what to do with it, but he had faith and he trusted the Lord.
We met Ken, who said he didn't have a devotion to St. Joseph, but that changed when he found this place.
I'm not really a devotee of St. Joseph before, but when I came here to Montreal as a working man, and now I do.
You have, of course, St. Brother André on your left, St. Joseph on your right.
Saints, like Brother André or Joseph, who spent their lives serving Christ, can sometimes be the lights that lead to something higher.
People outside the religion or just don't want to think about the religion, they just ask God, give me some lights. And God will give them the lights so they can come closer to Him.
And even if you can't make it to Montreal,
I think that Brother André would be quite cool with the idea of you not being able to come here, as long as you keep in mind that Saint Joseph is a moving saint.
He can meet you wherever you are. If you call to him, if you go to Joseph, he can lead you to God. Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
St. Joseph and St. Andre Bessette, pray for us. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week with more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.